my career began in 1967, actually by accident. I'd always been interested in science when I was at school, but I left without any really good qualifications and I didn't really know what to do next. I had one or two jobs in other sectors, such as banking, which didn't really appeal to me. But one area I was interested in was computers. Computers in the 1960s, of course, were very, very primitive compared with how they are today. But a lot of my friends had jobs as computer operators. And I noticed an advert in the Daily Telegraph one day asking for a computer operator to join a team in the Department of Pharmacology at the Royal College of Surgeons. In those days, I had no idea what pharmacology was, and I remember looking it up in the dictionary before I went for the interview. Anyway, when I got there, I found that that post had gone already, but they did offer me a job as a general laboratory technician. And because I had nothing else to do, I took it up. And within a few months, I realized this was what I always wanted to do. So I sort of discovered my passion for pharmacology in a rather roundabout way. And the man I was working for at that time was John Vane. And I started out as his technician, and we remained in contact all through our careers until John died earlier this century. Once I'd realized that I was fascinated by this new science, I decided to study part-time to gain more qualifications. And using those, I was able to go to Sheffield University and get a degree, actually, in physiology. And then I returned to John's lab as his PhD student in 1971. And this was a very auspicious time because John's lab had been working on aspirin at that time. And John had just published his first paper showing that aspirin prevented the generation of pro-inflammatory substances, which we call prostaglandins, in tissue extracts. And so my first project really was to try and extend these findings and to try and provide more evidence for his idea that this mechanism could explain the pharmacology of aspirin, which had always been a mystery ever since it was first marketed in about 1898. Well, the body has a very clever mechanism for preventing blood loss. Obviously, if you're injured and you begin to lose blood, if there's no mechanism for controlling this, then you'd quickly die from excessive blood loss. Now, the body has two or three systems which it employs. One of these is in the blood plasma itself, which is a clotting system, whereby proteins become almost like a sort of semi-rigid net around the site of the wound or the cut. Another feature of it is the constriction of the blood vessels around the site of the wound to prevent the flow of blood. But thirdly is the operation of small cells in the blood called platelets. These are tiny little cells, and they're rather abnormal in many ways because they don't have a nucleus like most cells. They're more like little fragments of a cell, but they have a very, very specialized role in controlling blood loss because they clump together and form a plug which blocks up the exit of the blood from the wound. And this can occur very, very rapidly, and the plug becomes very, very stable very, very quickly. And one of the interesting things about platelets is that they depend upon the generation of prostaglandin-like substances in order to do this. And this is what links them in to the use of aspirin as a cardiovascular drug, which is its main purpose today. So in the plasma, for example, there's a whole range of proteins, and there's a sort of a cascade through which when one protein becomes activated by contact with foreign surfaces, it cleaves or it splits another protein, and this in turn splits another protein, and eventually it causes the generation of a fibrin network in the blood, which is a huge network of insoluble proteins which tend to form a loose gel-like structure around the wound. And this occurs very, very rapidly, and forms the basis of the immediate plug in the wound. And then sticking onto this are the platelets. They tend to aggregate around these strands of fibrin. They stick together themselves. They form a very effective barrier to further blood loss. But they also release substances which cause the constriction of blood vessels. In addition to that, they liberate growth factors which enable the damaged blood vessel to repair and to renew itself in the fullness of time. And this plug, which it will be familiar to everybody because everybody has suffered some injury, a minor injury hopefully, at some time during their life, this plug becomes quite stable after a while. It then contracts and then pulls the edge of the wound together so that healing can commence. And then after a few days, the clot, the scab, if you like, on the wound falls off and you're left with a repaired blood vessel. Whilst platelets and blood clotting mechanisms are designed to protect you against injury and blood loss, sometimes they go wrong. And a particular case in point is during a disease called atherosclerosis. So in this disease, you get fatty deposits in the blood vessels, and these cause damage, and platelets sense this damage, and they begin to stick at the sites of the fatty deposits. When they do this, they may build up into quite a large clump, and they may also be associated with clotting proteins at the same site, which have deposited for the same reason. And if these break off, then they can be very dangerous. For example, if this happens in an artery, then the resulting platelet and protein plug may find its way around and get lodged in the heart or the brain, potentially causing a lot of damage. And we tend to refer to this as a stroke, for example, or a myocardial infarction. You can also get a different type of situation in the veins of the body. You probably all know it because it's sometimes referred to as deep vein thrombosis, and this is caused by the blood not moving quickly enough through the veins, particularly in the leg. And when this happens, you can get a sort of a clot forming in the static blood of the veins. So to combat this, there are various types of drugs that can be used, but they act at different points on the system. There's a range of drugs called blood clotting, well, we call them simply blood clotting agents, and these prevent the clotting of blood in various ways. One which is often used by patients is a drug called warfarin, and warfarin actually prevents the generation by the liver of an important factor which is important in the control of blood clotting. But increasingly, people are using aspirin in the same way because aspirin prevents prostaglandins from being synthesized by the platelets and prevents them from aggregating. And a very low dose of aspirin, for example, about 70, 75 milligrams per day, is all that's required to prevent platelets from becoming overactivated in this way. So it's a very common use for aspirin these days. Aspirin itself was actually invented as a replacement for salicylic acid, which was a very important drug in the late 19th century. Aspirin is actually a very simple derivative of salicylic acid, and it was marketed in the late 1890s by a German pharmaceutical company called Bayer, and it was very quickly shown to be superior to salicylic acid in its effects. So what are the effects of aspirin? Well, there are three main therapeutic effects. First of all, it reduces inflammation. Secondly, it reduces pain. And thirdly, it reduces fever. It also has a side effect of causing gastric damage, which is very, very prominent in about 30% of the people who take it. Aspirin became a huge success, and many other pharmaceutical companies copied not the structure itself, but the activity of the drug. And they came up with, I suppose there must have been about 20 or 30 drugs which had an identical pharmacology. In other words, they were all analgesic, they relieved pain, they were all antipyretic, they relieved fever and anti-inflammatory. And these group of drugs became known as the aspirin-like drugs for that reason, that they were so similar to aspirin. They had the same pharmacology, they had the same side effects, they all caused stomach problems. And really no one understood how they worked, which was very strange, really, considering that they were used so widely for the treatment of many inflammatory diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, gout, soft tissue injuries, headaches, migraines, period pains, everything like that. And a lot of people had guessed at what the explanation might be, but none of these explanations were wholly convincing. So in order to understand how aspirin works, we have to understand another advance which was happening in the late 60s and early 1970s. People had discovered that there was a group of biologically active substances called prostaglandins. They were originally called prostaglandins because they were thought to be found mainly in the prostate gland, but this turned out to be an error, but the name sort of remained. Turns out that prostaglandins can be made by virtually all cells in the body, and that they're often made in response to injury or infection or some sort of cell stress. And some of these prostaglandins have very interesting properties. So, for example, they have inflammatory properties, they can cause fever, and they can cause pain. And they can also protect the stomach against insult and injury. So they have these four effects. One problem in the late 60s and early 70s was that they were very difficult to measure. In those days, we didn't have the very sophisticated apparatus that we have today for measuring very, very tiny amounts of biologically active substances in tissue fluids and things. And the only way that we could really do it was using a technique called bioassay. And in this technique, you utilized the ability of the substance you were trying to measure to, for example, contract a piece of smooth muscle taken from an animal or from man, for that matter. And you could measure the concentration of it by the amount of contraction or relaxation that this substance produced. And the advantage of this technique was that it was very sensitive. It worked in the sorts of concentrations that you found in blood or tissue fluids. And it was also very selective because it was essentially a physiological response you were measuring. And John Vane had the idea of making this more sophisticated by putting several pieces of smooth muscle from different sites in the body into one assay. And he could therefore use the differential response of these bits of smooth muscle to characterize the properties of the active substance that he was trying to measure. So John had the idea that maybe the reason why aspirin had this pharmacology was that it prevented the generation, the synthesis in cells of prostaglandins. Because after all, prostaglandins were pro-inflammatory, they caused fever, they caused pain. And so if you blocked their synthesis, then you might reasonably explain how aspirin worked. And in his classic experiment of 1971, he used a piece of isolated smooth muscle from a gut, and this contracts to prostaglandins, so he was able to measure the generation of prostaglandins in this way, and he demonstrated that aspirin blocked their synthesis. And this was the first demonstration of this particular property of aspirin. The same year, his colleagues demonstrated that aspirin had the same effect in other systems as well, in other animals and also in man, that, for example, taking therapeutic doses of aspirin reduced synthesis of prostaglandins in young men. And the following year, we were able to show that it wasn't just aspirin, but in fact all the aspirin-like drugs which had this effect. And not only that, they had this effect within the sort of concentrations you would normally find in blood plasma after dosing patients to treat their particular disease, osteoarthritis, let's say. So this was very important. But interestingly enough, it was only the aspirin-like drugs which had this effect. For example, other analgesic agents, such as the opiates, morphine, for example, didn't have this effect, and neither did the steroids, which were also very powerful anti-inflammatory agents. They didn't block this enzyme either, and a whole range of other drugs were demonstrated to be inactive. So, in other words, this was an effect which was very, very specific for the aspirin-like drugs and that particular group of medicines. The reason why cells can make prostaglandins is because they have an enzyme, that's to say a protein that catalyzes a biochemical reaction. They have an enzyme which became known as the fatty acid cyclooxygenase, normally referred to as COX, COX. So this enzyme can combine some fatty acids with molecular oxygen to form these prostaglandins. And this enzyme is stuck onto the membranes of cells and is very, very difficult to remove it. So all the early experiments that were done with aspirin-like drugs and prostaglandins used quite crude preparations of cell extracts in order to generate prostaglandins for assay. This was a nuisance because it meant that you couldn't really get to understand very much about the enzyme itself, although you could make allowances for it in various ways, which everybody had to, because it took years of development and research before the technique for removing the enzyme off the membrane became widely used. And once this was achieved, it was possible to purify the enzyme completely, so it was a single protein. And when that had been done, and we're talking 1990s here, when that had been done, it was possible to crystallize it. And once it had been crystallized, using a technique called X-ray crystallography, it was possible to build up a model of the enzyme, and we could see how it worked and how aspirin and the other drugs interfered with its action to prevent it from working. So that was a big advance. There were also further advances during this time in the way in which we could assay the enzyme. To begin with, in the early 1970s, we used biological assay, but once the identity of the substrate, that's to say the material that was converted into prostaglandins, in this case a fatty acid called arachidonic acid, once this had been identified as the substrate, the starting material for prostaglandins, then manufacturers began to generate radioactive materials. And these were much more convenient to use as an assay. For example, you could incubate radioactive arachidonic acid with tissue extracts, and they would convert it into radioactive prostaglandins, which could be easily separated out and measured. So this was a very, very convenient way of doing assays. And further down the line still, very sensitive immunoassays were developed as well. These are assays which depend upon antibodies to prostaglandins to provide a very sensitive level of detection. And these are now the main way in which we measure prostaglandins in, for example, blood or tissue fluids or urine. The cyclooxygenase enzyme, the COX enzyme as we call it, once we understood its structure, it turns out to have a sort of a tunnel-like region in boring into the middle of the enzyme. When I lecture to my undergraduates, I always liken it to a sock, and the arachidonic acid slides into this sock, and once it's in the sock, in this tunnel region, the molecular oxygen can be introduced into the arachidonic acid, and this is how it becomes prostaglandins. Now, aspirin has a very interesting effect. It reacts with an amino acid, which is a component part of a protein. It reacts with an amino acid within this tunnel region in such a way that it modifies the structure of the tunnel. And this means that arachidonic acid can't get in, so it can't be oxygenated to prostaglandins. It's interesting because it's a unique mechanism of action to aspirin. All the other aspirin-like drugs block the tunnel in other ways. For example, by sitting at the mouth of the tunnel, the opening of the sock, if you like to think of it that way. But aspirin has this very, very unusual property of reacting chemically with an amino acid actually in the tunnel region. And this is one reason why it's a very, very special drug, even amongst all the other aspirin-like drugs. As we became more expert in understanding the effect of the aspirin-like drugs, people began to notice some anomalies in their ability to inhibit prostaglandin formation in different tissues. Actually, this was something that we'd flagged up in the early 1970s when we observed that paracetamol, which is not related to aspirin, in fact it was introduced before aspirin, but it has a very similar pharmacology in many ways, but not completely identical to aspirin, but we noticed that paracetamol could block prostaglandin production in brain tissue, but not elsewhere. And this seemed to tie in with the fact that paracetamol is a very good antipyretic agent. It reduces fever. It's a very good analgesic. It reduces pain. But it's not good at reducing inflammation. So we came up with the idea that maybe there were different types of cyclooxygenase in different tissues. But in those days, there wasn't really a mechanism for determining this other than crudely comparing the activity of drugs in tissue extracts. But other data which accumulated over the years suggested that, in fact, all the aspirin-like drugs had different abilities to inhibit prostaglandin generation in different tissues. And the question was, why was this? Now, the mystery was solved in the early 90s when it was discovered that there was another type of cyclooxygenase enzyme. And this was remarkably similar to the original type of cyclooxygenase, with one exception really, and that was that unlike the original cyclooxygenase, which we then began to call COX-1 or cyclooxygenase 1, this enzyme only normally appeared during episodes of inflammation, injury, or infection. So, for example, in white blood cells, you can't detect the enzyme at all under normal circumstances, but the new enzyme appears very rapidly if these cells detect, for example, microbes, germs, in other words. This new enzyme became known as COX-2, and as we came to understand its properties, it seemed to us that maybe this was the enzyme really that should be the target for the aspirin-like drugs, because the other enzyme, COX-1, was important for running the physiology of the body as well as any role it might have in inflammation. For example, in the stomach, it was known that COX-1 was important in generating prostaglandins, which had a protective effect on the stomach wall. And it was also important, for example, in initiating labour under some circumstances. And there were a number of other jobs which COX-1 did in the body, which were considered to be important physiological tasks. So when COX-2 was discovered, people began to think, well, maybe the reason why the aspirin-like drugs have this therapeutic effect is because they affect COX-2, because that's the one that appears during inflammation, injury, and infection. And maybe the side effects of aspirin, which include its ability to damage the stomach, are caused by its effect on COX-1, cyclooxygenase 1, which, as I've just explained, has important physiological functions as well. So this idea became known as the COX-1 good, COX-2 bad hypothesis. And when we tested all the aspirin-like drugs, it was found that virtually all of them inhibited both enzymes to some degree or other. And this caused people to think that perhaps a more selective inhibitor of the cyclooxygenase 2 would enable us to produce a drug which was a good anti-inflammatory agent without, for example, causing damage to the stomach. And this was an idea enthusiastically picked up by the pharmaceutical industry. And I think in what everybody admits is a tour de force, they came up within a few years with several extremely potent inhibitors of COX-2, which were selective for that enzyme and had very little effect on COX-1. And incidentally, it was the ability to purify and crystallize these two enzymes which enabled people to understand how it was possible to produce a drug which inhibited one and not the other, given the fact that these enzymes are so similar in respect to their biochemistry. This led to a release onto the market of several COX-2 selective inhibitors, or COXIBs, as they've become known. And they were shown in randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trials, which are the gold standard, to have significantly less gastric side effects than the old-fashioned aspirin-like drugs, if you want to call them those. But perhaps their effects were not quite so striking as people had hoped. However, it was noticed during one trial that patients taking these COX-2 inhibitors appeared to develop adverse cardiovascular effects. That's to say, there was an increase in the incidence of stroke, myocardial infarction, and other cardiovascular diseases. And this caused general alarm and panic in the community, with the effect that eventually some of these drugs were withdrawn from general use. The reason why this occurs is a bit controversial, but it prompted people to look at all the aspirin-like drugs, including the old-fashioned ones, including aspirin itself. And it was found out, I think to most people's amazement, that all these drugs could cause the same type of cardiovascular effects. And this seemed to be down to their ability to cause an increase in blood pressure. I should say that in order to see this, you normally had to treat for fairly long periods of time with fairly large doses of these drugs. But nevertheless, they all seemed to have the same effect. I think this was a big surprise to everyone. So now the situation is that we have some selective COX-2 inhibitors on the market still. We still have all the original aspirin-like drugs. All of them carry a sort of a warning that patients should be screened for potential cardiovascular side effects before they're used. And this is something which our physicians are now well used to monitoring. What's interesting is that aspirin itself, because it was more toxic than most on the gastric mucosa, has fallen out of use as an anti-inflammatory drug. And generally speaking now, it's only used as a cardiovascular drug because very low doses of it can be used to inhibit platelet prostaglandin formation and prevent aggregation. Its use as an anti-inflammatory has virtually ceased. When aspirin was first used to treat patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they would often have to take 6 to 9 grams of aspirin a day. So a normal aspirin tablet is about 300 milligrams. So 6 grams is about 18 tablets, which is a huge amount. And aspirin is one of the most toxic drugs on the gastric mucosa. And these big doses led to a lot of problems, which ranged from fairly mild dyspepsia and discomfort all the way up to gastric ulcers and duodenal ulcers, and a very, very dangerous situation. So with the advent of the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aspirin was really dropped as an anti-inflammatory agent in these very, very large doses. It was still used as an analgesic agent and an antipyretic in much smaller doses. The doses for treating those conditions are really just a couple of tablets every 4 hours or so, which is a completely different proposition from taking 6 to 9 grams a day. But even so, most people get on better with drugs like paracetamol than aspirin itself. However, the real breakthrough was the discovery that very, very tiny amounts of aspirin could affect platelets. And the reason for this is a bit unusual, but if you give a very tiny amount of aspirin, and all you need to give is about 80 milligrams, so 80 milligrams is much, much less, of course, than the standard 300 milligram tablet of aspirin. If you give this very tiny dose, it's only absorbed, it only has an effect in the blood that is draining the gastrointestinal tract. And what happens is the aspirin can interfere with the platelets in that blood, but by the time that blood gets to the liver, most of the free aspirin in the blood is destroyed. So this means that virtually no aspirin in this dose gets into the general circulation, and therefore its toxicity is hugely reduced, and it's, in most people, completely asymptomatic. So that's the reason why aspirin is a very useful cardiovascular drug in low doses, but is no longer used really to treat inflammation. A number of other interesting uses for aspirin have cropped up over the years. One of them was for the potential treatment of Alzheimer's disease. This was based upon some observations made in hospitals, which showed that patients taking aspirin-like drugs generally suffered less from Alzheimer's, or at least had a later onset. The subsequent trials which have been designed to show this have not been particularly conclusive, unfortunately. But another area, and that's to say the treatment of cancer with aspirin, has actually shown some promise. This is an area which has been bubbling along for many years, and I think it's now well established that in some particular types of colon cancer, that's to say a particular type which is passed on in families, so-called familial colon cancer, then the growth of the polyps in the colon can be prevented by taking low-dose aspirin, and indeed some other aspirin-like drugs. And I think this has been very well established, and I think that these drugs now form part of a fairly regular treatment regime. What's perhaps more controversial and more difficult to understand is the claim, and it's often based on good evidence, that aspirin may prevent other types of cancer, for example, breast cancer. What's slightly mysterious about this is the mechanism through which it occurs. Is it an effect on the cyclooxygenase enzyme, which we're seeing here? Is it because, for example, prostaglandins in some way can control or modulate tumour growth? Or is there some other action of aspirin that we haven't yet discovered? I think this is where there's a lot of interest in the area at the moment, and I look forward to some time in the future when this whole matter has been resolved, but it is very interesting. 1982 was a very important year for us in our lab, because that was the year that John Vane won the Nobel Prize. And perhaps I should explain how the Nobel Prize system works. The Nobel Prize is, of course, the most celebrated prize awarded to scientists. And it's never awarded to more than three people at once. And the Nobel Committee tends to award the prize to areas of research as much as to talented individuals. And in this particular case, the area to be rewarded, as it were, was the area of prostaglandin research, which had become very, very interesting, and lots of therapeutic ideas seemed to be coming out of this area. The prize was awarded to Sune Bergström, who was one of the Swedish scientists who was responsible for the purification of prostaglandins when they were first discovered, and did a lot of work on their biochemistry. Bengt Samuelsson was the second person. He was responsible for understanding how prostaglandins were biosynthesized by this enzyme, the cyclooxygenase, from arachidonic acid and molecular oxygen, and worked out all those biosynthetic pathways. And the third person, of course, was John Vane, whose work on aspirin had shown why the prostaglandins were very important in pathology, but also his work had given scientists very useful tools with which to probe the actions of prostaglandins in normal physiology as well. People use these drugs as ways of testing whether prostaglandins are involved. So 1982 was a landmark year, and some of us decamped to Stockholm in the winter to see John receive his Nobel medal. And I suppose it was one of the memories that remains in our collective mind for the longest. It was a very happy and significant time. At the time of John's Nobel Prize, he'd moved to the Wellcome Foundation, which in those days was a pharmaceutical company based in Beckenham in Kent. And he'd taken some of his close colleagues with him, including me, and he'd formed a prostaglandin research group there, and we had been working there for some years already and made several interesting discoveries. However, in about 1986, I decided to leave the company because I was offered a chair of pharmacology at the University of Bath. And a few years after that, the company was taken over by Glaxo and eventually essentially disappeared as a pharmaceutical company. John left, and after a year or so, he was offered an office in what used to be St. Bartholomew's Hospital Medical School campus in Charterhouse Square in London. So John established an office in the medical school, and he had his PA with him, but nothing else. But Glaxo offered to provide some money to form a new laboratory here, and this got off to a good start. John began to attract some new PhD students and some new colleagues, and he decided to call his new laboratory the William Harvey Research Institute. The reason he did that was because William Harvey, who was the physician scientist who discovered the circulation of the blood in the 17th century, actually worked at Bart's Hospital for a while, and his name is associated very strongly with his hospital. And because John was interested in the cardiovascular system, that's to say the heart and the blood and the clotting system and so on, he decided it would be an appropriate name. To begin with, there weren't many people in the institute, but he wrote to me and to some other colleagues of his and said, why don't you come and join me here, and together we can put the institute in a very, very much better position, and we can devote our time to doing research, which was, for me at the time, a bit of a relief because I was spending more and more time administering and much less time in the lab. So in 1989 or 1990, I joined John here, and the following year, John, myself, and some other colleagues formed the William Harvey Research Institute as a formal medical charity registered for that purpose. This was really the beginning of the William Harvey Research Institute. We were lucky enough to acquire some funding from the pharmaceutical industry to enable us to start the institute going with more personnel. And it gradually grew over the years. I think there was about 30 people when I came. There's about 300 and something now. It gradually grew over the years, and after John retired, the institute directorship passed eventually to me, and I decided that we really ought to be merged with the medical college, because getting independent funding for such a large institute was becoming more and more problematic. And also, we wanted to stabilize the position of our very, very bright young scientists who were coming up through the system. And we discussed this a lot over the years, but when I was institute director, I negotiated the final details with the medical college and signed along the dotted line, so the institute became part of the medical college of what was then St. Bartholomew's Hospital and the Royal London Hospital School of Medicine and Dentistry. And it has remained so today. It's got much bigger. I think there's over 300 people in the institute today. Most of them work in the area of inflammation or cardiovascular disease. Science is an interesting pastime from all sorts of reasons, and there are different traditions in science. John always came from what you might call the curiosity-driven tradition. In this tradition, you find an interesting observation and you pursue it and you see where it leads you. And in his hands, this proved to be hugely successful. For example, the aspirin story came out of it, and also the discovery of ACE inhibitors. These are drugs which are used to control high blood pressure, also came out of this same tradition. So it is an extremely fruitful way of tackling science. Unfortunately, these days, people think that one should be more applied and that somehow if you set out with an objective in mind, you're more likely to achieve it in science. So, for example, had you set out to find drugs to control blood pressure, you'd be more likely to find agents which did so than if you simply followed curiosity-driven research. Well, I think that John's success proves otherwise, but it's something which is constantly batted backwards and forwards amongst people because people have different opinions about how research should be done. But in either case, really, whether it's curiosity-driven or what you might call applied science, you generally start with a guess about how something's happening. In other words, you have a hypothesis. You make an observation. You make a guess about why things work out that way. You design an experiment to test that guess or that hypothesis. 9 times out of 10, your guess is wrong. You dump it. You make another guess. You make another experiment. And hopefully, eventually, you find one which fits the facts that you see. This is the so-called scientific method. It's characterized really by a willingness to dump ideas which don't correspond with facts, rather than dumping facts that don't correspond with your ideas. That's what differentiates the scientific method from most other forms of human thought, I think. I have many interests at the moment. Some of these relate to the actions of other types of anti-inflammatory drugs, but I've also become interested in the areas of biosecurity and the potential misuse of science. This is a complex area, but generally speaking, when you're trained as a scientist, not much time is given over to explaining to you the potential ramifications of the use of discoveries that you may make for example, militarization of science. An example might be if you discovered a new microorganism which was very pathogenic and you decided to publish the results, this could give bioterrorist groups a new idea for waging biological warfare. So how should you react to that discovery? Should you publish it? Should you not publish it? What steps would you take to ensure that the integrity of your findings was preserved in a way? It's a complex area where ethics and science overlap. It's often difficult to fathom out exactly how to deal with particular issues. But on the other hand, it's very important that students are exposed to these ideas so that they can make up their own mind. My own personal opinion here is that science is simply the discovery of new knowledge, and as such, it doesn't really have a moral value in any way. It acquires a moral value depending on how it's used. And there was a very good example of this a few years ago with the American anthrax letters. So according to the FBI, the person who sent these letters, which killed a number of people and infected many others, was actually somebody who worked in the civilian unit which aided the military in producing anthrax vaccines. And the person who was responsible was actually a very, very well-known microbiologist, and he was responsible actually for making one of the vaccines to protect American troops in the event that anthrax was used as a biological warfare agent in the field. But he used the same knowledge to purify some anthrax spores, which he then sent in letters to politicians, people in the media, and so on. So this is a perfect example of how it's the use to which science is put which is the key thing in this type of debate. Scientists and diplomats and politicians have worked together to formulate the terms of two important conventions which govern the behaviour in warfare. One is the Chemical Weapons Convention, which seeks to ban war gases such as those we saw in World War I, for example, sarin and gases like that. And the Biological Weapons Convention, which seeks to ban all weapons which are, for example, infectious organisms and so on. This became an important part of my work for some years, and we have been working towards trying to reconcile these two conventions. in a way which would enable a more complete coverage of the types of weapons that are becoming available now through our increased understanding of, for example, molecular biology. It's interesting to note that the Biological Weapons Convention and the Chemical Weapons Convention have been very highly honoured. In fact, recently, the Chemical Weapons Convention won the Nobel Peace Prize. The Organisation for Prevention of Chemical Weapons was awarded the prize in recognition of their efforts in furthering world peace.